Hello there and welcome back to the Film Score Podcast. Today my guest is Andrew Scott Bell. Now you might be familiar with Andrew's work through horror, a lot of indie horror, especially on the recent horror film Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. And so, not coincidentally, Andrew and I primarily talk about his score for the upcoming Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey Part 2, which hits theaters March 26th through the 28th, though I'm sure, like some other recent horror films, I think the original one as well, depending on the reception, its run might be extended. And this was really fun because Andrew had a bunch of the weird instruments that he used on the score at hand in his studio, and a number of music cues from his scores for the first and second films lined up. So a lot of times when he's talking about an instrument, a cue, a particular approach, he can then press a button or grab the instrument and start playing. So you'll get a lot of music in this interview. Now, of course, it's what you hear is not one-to-one of what'll appear in the film or the score. Some of that, of course, is simply because it's running through his audio rather than dropping the finished, mastered, final version of the cue into this. And I was really impressed, actually, with how well it turned out from his end. And of course, as usual, we veer into other topics as well. Now you can find more about Andrew on his social media, his website. You can do the same for me. Like I said, the film and the score are coming out soon. And coming out soon as well, quite a few other excellent interviews. But those are in the future. Until then, sit back and enjoy. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today. How have you been?
I've been good. Thank you. Just finished Pooh 2 on Monday, and I'm pretty deep in the next movie already. So just busy and finding time to make time for myself and go on walks and stuff like that too.
Well, and I appreciate you making a little time to talk to me as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've been listening to the podcast for a long time. And it's an honor to join you and be on an episode. So thank you.
No, and thank you. And it does go back to something we talked about a little while ago of, for me, trying to get a good mixture of larger names on there. I've got interviews with three of the Oscar-nominated scores.
Yeah, that's
amazing. But also trying to make room for folks that are in earlier stages scoring indie projects because it's such an important part of the film ecosystem, and there's so much great, exciting work going on in there, too. And
totally.
If people don't hear about that, I mean, what a loss.
Right. I think when we spoke about that, I was thinking a lot about when I first started out in like 2010 and 11, you know, my wife bought for me Richard Belice's book, The Emerging Film Composer, which I think every young new composer should read. But he's very much talking about his experience with the studio system and like hiring an orchestra and like a music editor and orchestrators and all of these things that only in the last 20 years are starting to become less and less common as you're starting out. So it was good knowledge to know and think about for like down the road as I've now worked with orchestras, you know, like 10 years later. But it was really when I joined the Facebook group when I first moved to LA and there was a Facebook group started called Perspective that really I got to see behind the scenes of like that middle ground between when you're first starting out and when you're working on major studio pictures with a full orchestra budget and you're going to London to record at Abbey Road. Like what is the life of a film composer in that middle space where you're doing indie films and a lot of it ends up being the mock-ups on our computer, the MIDI sounds, you know, how do we bring those to life? Like, what is the world like before I had a manager and an agent? How do I negotiate my contract? Like all those things are really helpful to learn. So I think it's great that you have such a wide variety of composers on your show.
Well, I appreciate that. And I have heard so many good things about the people that are contributing on that Facebook group and just the amount of, you know, literal perspectives you're getting, that it seems like something integral for, I mean, probably a composer in any stage of their career.
Yeah, it is sometimes a bit of a mind trip on that group, because like you'll be giving advice and chatting, and because you posted on, you know, somebody asking for advice and you give a little bit of advice, and then like a day later you'll get a notification that says like Hans Zimmer also commented on it, and you're like, okay, let's go see what Hans said. And it's always, you know, it's just full of such wisdom, because Hans Zimmer might give some advice based on his experience, but his is very different than mine, and it's good to have all those different, pun intended, or not pun intended, but I guess that's why it's called perspective, because it's all of these different perspectives, and it kind of melts all together in the experience of the industry. It's really neat.
And it does go to what you were saying a few minutes ago about the perspective of that book you were reading or you'd read, and you see so many anecdotes of composers, let's say in their 50s, 60s, who got their start by basically just sending a demo out to a ton of people and someone responds. Mm-hmm. And it's like little things like that, that from my understanding kind of don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, I know that I think you had gotten your start doing an internship with Joe Trapanese, then became an assistant for the composer Alex Werman.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get involved with those on the front end?
That was when I first moved to LA, and it really does feel like my career started when we moved to LA in 2015 and that internship with Joe, who's fantastic. He has a relatively small team compared to a lot of others at his level, but that allows him to cycle through interns. He doesn't want to keep an intern for too long because they're unpaid internships, though he gives really great IMDb credit. So that is something unique to his program that he has. But he tries to cycle through his interns pretty quickly so that you get like 2 months experience with him and then go off into the world. And you just learn so much from him because he's just so generous. He invited me in one day while he was writing, and I just got to sat in the back with a notepad and like keep quiet and not distract him. But I learned so much just like sitting in that room. But I had a whole 5 to 7 year career before moving to LA. That was when we lived on the East Coast, we lived in DC, and that was like a lot of short films, commercials. DC is a big hub for documentaries, so I scored a bunch of documentaries, one of which was a nature documentary from South Africa. But like I said, it really feels like when we moved to LA, getting that internship with Joe was like a fresh start. It felt like I was starting over in the best way. Like it felt like that was when my career really started. And then soon after that, I scored a short film called Rocket that went on to win a Student Academy Award the following year. So from the internship with Joe and what I learned there to the experience of like going to the Academy to screen my first LA short film, I just feel like I was very blessed to start my life in LA that way.
In those several years, 6, 7 years before that internship, like you said, you were scoring projects, short films, documentaries. Did it feel like those were still useful years for you, even though it felt like your career kind of, you know, started after them?
Yeah, they were incredibly useful. I went to school in Virginia, and there weren't really, I mean, maybe there are now, but in the like mid-2000s, there weren't really any film scoring programs in in-state schools in Virginia. Like I could have maybe gone to somewhere in New York or come out to like USC, but I just wasn't, as a teenager in high school, like I wasn't thinking beyond like in-state schools. So I kind of had to craft and create my own like film composition or music composition degree paired with a film studies minor. So I studied classical orchestration, music theory, post-tonal music theory, got up my bachelor's in music with a minor in film studies. Like I studied, there was a great Bernard Herrmann class that I was in and a great class about like editing and stuff, but it was very minimal. My film studies minor was very minimal, and it certainly wasn't about film scoring. So I came out of school with all these tools for orchestration and writing and harmony and voicing and a great understanding of how the academic music world works, but very little understanding about how to sync to picture and what the film scoring landscape looks like, you know? So those 5, 6 years when I lived in DC and I was, you know, teaching piano lessons on the side and doing summer music camps and stuff were integral, because it was like a very forgiving place to like learn all those stuff that I didn't get in school. Go to on YouTube and see, well, how do I bring a picture? How do I sync the time code? You know, like all the technical side of film scoring that I now take for granted, I learned in those years before moving to LA, so that when I moved to LA, I wasn't like a fumbling fool being like, wait, but why can't I record with an orchestra? I did in college. You know what I mean? My experience of writing music at university was very much like, here's the sheet music, go play it on stage. That's very different from what I do now. So those early years before moving to LA were integral in like me just fumbling around and finding the tech side of what we do.
With respect to the film studies side of things, obviously when you're creating a score, it has to be, you would hope, attached to some aspect of the film, whether it just be the literal narrative or plot or underlying themes, the characters overtly or implicitly. So do you think that taking those classes to have a better understanding of film itself and not just the music?
I think so. I mean, that's a great question. I think that that gave me a different perspective than just studying film music. If I were to have taken like a film music program, though I'm sure that there's film studies within a film music program, it was a unique way to study like music completely separate from film and then kind of take those studies. Though my film studies minor was very minimal. It was like a Hitchcock class and an editing class and like a documentary style class with like the journalism side of things. But it was neat to go and pepper that in alongside my electives and a lot of my music courses. And like, I remember in that Hitchcock class, the professor kind of allowed me to tweak some of the assignments like a little bit. Like one of them was about the shower scene, and we had to dissect the shower scene like edit by edit by edit. And he let me, of course, I had to do that still. This is me being the person that I am, but I had to do that still. And he also allowed me to like in the next paragraph talk about what the music was doing during these cuts and like how it was affecting the viewer in tandem with the edits. You know, I guess I was doing two papers in one, but it was exciting for me, you know, and he let me do it. So
that's awesome. And I think talking about the music composition background broadly, it's something that I've found interesting with your approach, because I think a lot of modern and really going back a little further, horror music in particular, looking at it broadly, has kind of moved away a bit from really obvious thematic approaches and melodies, and it's more sound design creating an atmosphere. Yet I think with a lot of your approach to it, it's bringing that thematic background back in. You know, sometimes it is truly just noisy and chaotic, and sometimes it's still more melodic. Where do you attribute that approach to?
I think we're all collages of the music that of our influences, what we listen to when we're young and what we studied. We all work for our taste, if that makes sense. And I just love James Horner, and I love Bernard Herrmann, and I just love Jerry Goldsmith and John Williams and Alan Silvestri. So I think that those influences like can't help but bubble up through me. And even when I'm like tasked with writing something like that's not melodic, like there's still something that pierces through. In Winnie too, I'm thinking about a moment that even the stuff that I wrote for Tigger was like frenetic and crazy, because now Tigger's in the public domain. But there's still like, if it's not like a traditional, what one might call like a melody, then there's like a rhythmic melody to the Tigger stuff. Here, I'll play a little sample of it. I think I just can't help but write thematically, which can be a little frustrating sometimes when you're working with somebody who doesn't want that, because they hired me for a reason based on previous work. So I have to find what about my work they sought after. And sometimes that might be like more the texture of my violins when I record them than my James Horner-esque melodies on the brass or something. You know what I mean? So it's always a fun challenge. But a lot of what we studied in orchestration was classical and late classical and romantic and into the 21st century, or into the 20th century. One of the assignments was to take a Debussy piano etude and then orchestrate it for full wind ensemble. So I was learning a lot of those types of harmonies and textures that I think, like John Williams and a lot of film scores from the 80s and 90s were kind of influenced by. So I think it's natural for me. And then, of course, like growing up before I went to school, like I listened to James Horner and John Williams and Alan Silvestri religiously. I remember I would get a new CD and like try to get my friends to listen to it. And at one point, my friend Matt, who was so frustrated with me, was like, Andy, because I was like, dude, I got a new CD if you want to come over and listen to it. And he was like, does it have lyrics? And I was like, no, it's Tomorrow Never Dies. Then he was like, I only listen to music with lyrics. I'll never forget him saying that on the phone. Just because, you know, he's just so frustrated with his nerdy friend being like, you know, gotta come over and check out the CD. And it's like, you know, Mission Impossible or something. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I think that just my life and experience and my preferences inform my love of melodies. I think melodies can really transform a viewing experience. And there's different ways to accomplish melodies too, right? Like you were saying, more sound designy textures can, when used thematically, can evoke emotion and tie connections between different scenes in a different way that, like, you know, an oboe melody would do a similar job, you know?
Well, and of course, so much of that is really dependent on the film itself, the period, the setting, the genre. I mean,
totally.
I'm sure you can have like a Philip Glass style minimalist score for an action film, but then it would just be weird. Whereas, you know, there's like propulsive percussion instead, just feels more natural.
It feels more natural, yeah. And I think also it comes down to people start to seek you out for what they've heard you for, from what they've heard from you before. Like Joe, for example, was when I was interning for Joe, he was working on, I think, Allegiant, one of the Divergent movies. And people, they sought him out for obvious reasons, because he's done a ton of action and he's just so incredibly good at writing those big tension and action in these big, massive set pieces. And he's really smart about, one of the things I learned from him that I'll never forget is writing with the sound design in mind, like making sonic space so that you're not squashing on the explosions, you know, that you know that there's a helicopter. So let's write for strings and like a high synth part right here, because that helicopter is going to be like, you know, chopping underneath a little bit. So I took that immediately and was on the next movie that I scored, you know, when I was done working with Joe, was that Rocket short film, which is about dirt track racing in like the 1940s and 50s. And there's a big race at the beginning, and it was, when I scored it, it was all violins, trumpets going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, just staying, just because I knew that there was a car engine there. I don't know how I got on this topic, but I guess that's the nature of good conversation.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it.
Which you're really good at, you know, as I listen to episodes, you're just really great at getting us to ramble, I think.
Hey, thank you. And one thing I'll say, I do a lot of editing. I cut plenty of things out. Comments like that always stay in. Any praise I get, hell yeah, keep it in, keep going.
I love it.
but I appreciate that. But we're talking about kind of some more traditional instrumental palettes in a lot of ways. And both of the Blood and Honey films now, scores now, the part two comes out in March 28th, I want to say, about four weeks from now.
Yeah, it's going to be March 26th through the 28th. So there's 3 days with the possibility of extending it, I guess, depending on ticket sales. I don't know how all that works. I'm just thankful that I, you know, have a movie in theaters. It's very fun.
And so I've been fortunate enough to hear your score for that. And so for both of those films, it is a mixture of some more traditional instruments and then plenty of weird sound sources that you could argue are instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's maybe a philosophical question beyond this conversation right now. But I wanted to ask you just broadly about what goes through your mind in trying to find more unusual sounds, sources of sounds that you think would be more fitting for a score like these?
That's a great question. Thank you. What goes through my mind, I think, I don't remember who said this. It's not something that I've come up with. It might have been Hans Zimmer in some interview somewhere, but it stuck with me. Either whoever it was, it stuck with me. And it's that the active verb for music, I mean, of course we can listen to music, but that the active verb for music is to play. We play the piano. We, even when we're putting on a record, he's like, hey, you want to play some music? To me, that is such a reminder to be playful in what we do, even when it is stressful. And I try to keep that mindset of being playful in everything I do. And recently in the past, I guess, four years, I don't know, since around the pandemic or something, I've been turning to adding strange and unusual textures from unique places and instruments into my soundscape as a way to keep it fresh and fun for me. I hope not in a way that feels gimmicky. Like, I hope when you hear those things, they're just part of the landscape, part of the brushstrokes, I guess, if you will, of like the painting that I'm crafting. I hope they don't stand out in too much of, like, you know, playing the music stand as a percussion instrument, and it's like rattling and shaking and making this crazy sound where I could very easily have just pulled out a tom and done the same thing.
Yeah.
There is a spot that uses the music stand, for example. I can play that real quick.
Cool. Yeah.
It's kind of hard to hear. I mean, it's in there. It's a texture in there, and it's this kind of rattling. Yeah. It sounds like a drum.
But you could easily hear the rattle kind of reverberating after each.
Yeah. Hit. And those kinds of things are fun for me. They bring a new, I don't know, they bring some spice to the music that I write, I think. And I've also been working with an experimental luthier, to some who might not know. You know, I know, but a luthier is somebody who makes string instruments. And I found this experimental luthier online on Instagram, and he crafted for me a brand new instrument that is called the Glory Box, because it was made for a movie called Glorious. And I've been working with him ever since. The Glory Box, let me grab it real quick. The Glorious Box has only one string right now because I beat the hell out of it for Pooh too. But yeah, so it's been through the ringer. I need to put more strings on it. But they're ukulele based strings with a ukulele based neck, and then a cigar box, like a custom body that you can order online, and then a paint can as a resonator lid. But the real joy of the Glory Box is that inside is like, I don't even know, like seven springs all connected to the input jack, so that when you play, the signal goes through all those strings like a built-in spring reverb for old Fender amps or something.
Interesting.
And creates this massive, massive sound. Like, I barely have to add any reverb to it. It comes out with this natural, massive sound. Let me play that sample for you, because it sounds great. It sounds like, you know, if you didn't know, it sounds like maybe just the cello, but it's the Glory Box. Forever, you know.
That's it's so awesome. Cool. That is, it's so cool. That is so, even ominous doesn't quite give it justice for how deathly it sounds. That's great.
Yeah, it has this, I mean, it's not a very big instrument. Like, I set it on my lap and it comes just at the right, you know, like if your listeners could see, like, it's on my lap and then the headstock is just a little bit above the top of my head. So it's not, the strings are not very long, but they're wide. So they have this, it has a really low sound to it, especially when bowed. And there, it's a ukulele bass string, so it's not smooth like the cello. Like, it has a grit to it that I think comes across when you bow it with a cello bow.
And that's the sort of thing that I think for listeners or for people trying to write about film music, at least in my view, it's almost increasingly futile to try to say, unless it's an obvious, just like classic orchestral type score, to hear a sound and be like, oh, that's 100% a cello, because right. no one's going to guess that that's the glory box instead. When I'm, right. I remember, I think I've mentioned this once before, when I was talking to Colin Stetson a little while ago about his score for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the new one, he was telling me that he was being interviewed about it. And someone was like, oh, what was it like using chainsaws in your score? And he was like, what are you talking? Like, I didn't do that. But the palette that's available is really kind of endless, both in sources and then what you're able to do with them. And so it's just, I don't know. I love that the universe of those sounds is effectively endless. But I don't even bother trying to figure out where so many of them come from, because
you can't sometimes. Like you can try, but really that thing that sounds like it might sound just like a trombone, but it's flexible plumbing tubing, you know, that I call the Tigger tube, you know, like that's, I think functionally on the score, it sounds like a trombone, but it has a slightly different quality that is a little bit more frantic. Like, just like, you know, like somebody might be listening to the Glory Box and they might say, oh, why not just like record a cello and add a bunch of reverb to it? And if there's like slight differences in these things, the same, somebody said that to me about the Bihai Valin. They were like, does the Bihai Valin really sound like, and for your listeners, like the Bihai Valin is something that Tyler made for me, which is literally a violin that he put inside of a beehive for 2 years, and the bees built their hive like inside and around the violin. And I played it on both Winnie 1 and Winnie 2. And does it sound functionally like that different from a violin if I like loosen the strings? I guess not, but there is some kind of quality to it that makes it unique. Here it is just solo, the Bihai Valin. You know, like functionally, that is a tremolo on a violin, right? You know, it sounds a little bit dead. It's not as resonant. Mm-hmm. Some of the overtones are piercing through more than usual because there's nothing to like resonate them. So it's just the strings. But the real magic of the Bihai Valin is like, you know, there's an off quality to it that's still not quite a viola or a violin. And when you layer multiple takes together, it really starts to shine as a different instrument. Like, that's, I think, unsettling. It sounds to me like bees swarming, you know?
Oh, yeah, it definitely does.
Yeah.
But, because you've kind of segued into this a bit and laid the seed a few minutes ago, I mean, how are you determining whether finding a more unorthodox source for a sound or for music goes from the thing that is, you know, the most exact to what you want versus becoming just gimmicky instead?
Oh, I think that's a good question. I mean, I think the Bihai Valin itself is kind of a gimmick in like headlines or like interviews or pictures that I post.
Yeah.
But then I think the way that it's used in the score, at least I hope, is to create an effect and not just the gimmick alone. Like, I'm a relatively unknown, I think, film composer. And so absolutely, like, the Bihai Valin was something that conceptually was, though it's fun for me to be playful, it was hopefully going to wow people and make them click on a link or something and check out who I am and who the movie is and stuff. But then I think just the use of it, like, I never want it to distract from the music itself. I hope that it's like folded into the sound of the score and not in a obtrusive or like distracting way. I think that's what you're asking, is like, how do I make sure it's not just a gimmick? I think I try to use it in musical ways and not have it be so forward. Here's the Bihai Valin in Pooh 2, which I use a little bit differently than I used it in Pooh 1. Well, here's the Glory Box right there. I'm actually playing the Glory Box in a pizzicato. Boom, boom, in that. I'm trying to find where the Bihai Valin comes in. There it is. There's something unsettling about it, and it very much could have just been like an ostinato violin, or I guess it, in this register it would have to be a viola on like the low C or maybe D, I think it is. But there's something off about it. There's something grindy about it that's playing different than a viola would play. But I think only if you knew that that was the Beehive violin would it stand out to you. You know what I'm saying? Like, if Colin had used the chainsaw in his Texas Chainsaw Massacre, he probably would have done so in a way that doesn't sound like a chainsaw.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Absolutely. Like, not like, oh, let me go vroom, 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 vroom. He would process it and bring it in and create this soundscape or, you know. And I'm a very, my influences are very traditional. So I'm always like, when I'm talking to Tyler about creating a new instrument, it's always like, can we make a cello out of a bear skull and use the bear skull as the resonating chamber of the cello? But ultimately, it's still a cello. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So very much like the glory box is still functions kind of as like a bass or like bowing a bass or a cello. And the Tigger tube very much functions like a trombone. But because it's made of PVC, you can wobble it. Which you can do with a trombone slide. You can, but it feels different when you're actually like bending the tube. You're actually like shaking your head and your hand and your whole body shakes. I don't know. I think it's fun. I think it's fun that it sounds like a trombone, but then also slightly off, you know? Like a vuvuzela or what are they, how do they call it?
Like a
soccer game or something, you know?
Because people can't see this, like in, you described it earlier, but it is literally a like a trombone mouthpiece with a, let's call it 4 foot long and like inch wide, very flexible pipe. Seeing you holding it and then playing it and hearing it is just like not what I expect it to sound like whatsoever. It's
really,
it's yeah. I mean, because like I can, I, you know, I imagine you like looking at a PVC pipe. I've got them throughout my house, down in this room, like. I can imagine just looking at it blowing in and it's just going to sound like I'm blowing into a pipe and not like a genuine instrument.
Right. Yeah. It's so funny. We just bought this house in September and I had to do some work on one of the pipes and I bought way too much. I bought extra just because I knew I would mess something up.
Yeah.
So I bought extra of this tubing and, you know, got the little thing. It's called like a shark bite and you put the tube in, you put the shark bite in, shark bite out, and it has to be flexible so that you don't have to like take your whole wall off. You just take a little square out, you know, and then you can flex the tube in and put the shark bite. Anyways, I had all this extra and I was getting ready for Putu and I like, the thing about a recording studio is sometimes it becomes like the storage unit for the whole family, you know? And so I was walking down to like start Putu and the tube was just like sitting there in the stairwell and I was like, but I could put a mouthpiece in that. I tried a trumpet mouthpiece first, but it didn't really have the same quality that I wanted. So I pulled out my trombone case and stole the mouthpiece. But, you know, and the thing about the Tigger tube is you go, you record it, and it sounds pretty cool dry. But then once you stick it through reverb and do some compression and do some panning and, you know, a little bit of distortion. It turns into a whole different quality, you know?
Sticking with sort of the palette and your approach on these films, this is going to be kind of a, it'll be a compound two-part question. So I'll warn you in advance.
Okay, I'll take a sip of coffee then.
All right. So prepare. So I know with the first film, it had a budget of about $50,000 overall. And obviously, and unfortunately, only a small part of that's going to go to music. That's just kind of the nature of indie films. And yet, I remember when I watched that movie, what really struck me about your score was it didn't sound like an indie, no-budget, in-the-box score. It sounded not just like real instruments, but like really robust. And so the two parts here are, noting that with the limited budget and I assume limited time, how do you go about creating a score or a, you know, a cue, a track that doesn't sound like it's coming from something with a minimal budget? And then with Pooh 2 having, I assume, a more substantial budget behind it, how has that, the extra money going to the score, affected your approach?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, let's talk about Pooh One first, I guess, and I'll pull up some of those cues. I really loved working on that movie. It's kind of intentionally made to be like a B-horror fun. That was the goal for Reese. It wasn't ever really meant to be in theaters. That is kind of just all came out of going viral, you know?
Yeah.
And they did a bunch of reshoots. And I just, when I came onto Pooh 2, they were very upfront with me saying that there's not really a lot of money. But I still wanted to do it as an investment in them and their vision on this whole thing, but also as an investment in me and a great way to have fun. Like I said, like I was saying earlier, music is to me is about being playful. And when I watched the rough cut of that movie and I heard them all, sometimes the rough cut has like on-set audio, and I heard them all like laughing between takes while Pooh is like running somebody's head over with the tires of a car. And I heard like cut, and then the whole crew just like bursting out in laughter. I was like, I want to be part of this with these people having fun. And so it really was just an exercise in joy, I think, to be part of a movie that was just so outrageous. I mean, Winnie the Pooh as like a Michael Myers is just so funny to me. But like I said, there wasn't really a lot of music budget. I mean, I think I spent the music budget in hotel stays and just going up to San Francisco where Tyler, the luthier, lives to pick up the Beehive violin. My manager went up with me. So I spent most of the music budget in gas and hotel for just that trip. And then I hired a couple of musicians or one musician friend of mine. And yeah, so it wasn't really very hefty at all. But I never let, like, once I agree to do a project, like, I try to put the monetary side of it just out of my mind completely and treat it as if it's the next Marvel movie, because I just try to not let the size of a budget, once I agree to do a picture, it doesn't factor into any of my choices. Mm. I'll treat it exactly the same in how I approach it and tackle it, you know? For example, one of my early ideas was, because the whole, like, the mission of Pooh 1, a little bit different in Pooh 2, but the mission of Pooh 1 was like taking something so serious and pushing it and making it so serious that it's hysterical and funny and fun. So one of my early ideas for Pooh 1 was, oh my God, Reese, wouldn't it be great if we got a choir singing in Latin? Because like I was thinking about Jerry Goldsmith's like The Omen score and like how epic and serious it is. Or like, I know it's not Latin, but in Phantom Menace, Duel of the Fates in Sanskrit, John Williams says, Kura! It's like so serious. It's the Duel of the Fates. And there's this massive choir. And he was like, yeah, that's funny, but it sounds expensive. And I was like, well, he's right. It is. We can't just record a whole choir. And, you know, I could get sample sound libraries, but then it's like you get the sound library of like whatever Latin words they have pre-recorded, which most of the time is like mass and like religious texts and stuff. Like, common Latin words. And I really wanted to translate, if somebody were to translate these Latin words, what would they find? And they would find sanguis et mel, which means blood and honey in Latin, you know? And I just thought it'd be so funny to have this like deathly serious choir chanting blood and honey, you know, when you actually translate it. So he was right. That was very expensive. So instead I kind of like, well, what can I do for no money? Well, I can sing it all myself and reinterpret it in my mind and change it to be like a kind of like a Russian men's chorus instead of like a full both parts, high and low voices chorus. So this is me, maybe like 26. Sometimes it depends on the cue. Sometimes if there's a lot of orchestra, I don't need as many layers of myself. Sanguis et mel. So that's probably like, now that I'm listening to it, like 16 of me layered and singing different voices. And when you put it all together with the orchestra, even though there's only 16 of me, I think it's like suggestively feels bigger. It feels like a full, you know, 50-piece men's chorus, because whatever is like piercing through the orchestra is enough to trick your brain into thinking there's 50 people on a stage. And I think that's how I bring a lot of production value to my music, is like I will play a violin part 16 times. And because it's layered with the MIDI and all the other things, and maybe I'll record it like a trumpet stab or some trombone parts, and our brain kind of attaches to those real elements and then kind of by suggestion believes that the fake drums are real and that the fake oboe is real. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can't play the oboe, but I can put in a trumpet part and record a violin texture. And because there's something human in there, those human recorded and layered instruments are kind of like getting into the club of our brain and then being like, hey, all the fake instruments, you can come in with me. Come on in to the club. And I think our brain is like, it makes the whole thing feel real, if that makes sense. I think that answers the first question in a very long way. I'd like to play a little sample from the first movie. It's my favorite track. It's In Which Pooh Tries Ride Sharing, where I did these trombone clusters and layered them with a sample library. And then I recorded trumpet on top of that. And I think that's this part. And of course, everything but the trumpet and some of those trombone clusters. Most of the rest of that is on my computer, you know, which all sound fantastic. I mean, they alone sound great. But, you know, recording your own instruments, I think, even if it's just like a violin texture on top of everything going crazy, you know, I'm not a very good violinist, so I'm just making textures and sounds. I think that helps give a pass in our brain to the rest of what you're hearing. So I try as often as possible to layer in a couple of real things, whether it's the beehive violin or the skull cello or, you know, or a real violin or a real cello. I have those over there too. And I have a trumpet and a trombone and a clarinet. And I think that answers your first question, which is like, how on like no money did I trick people into thinking it was at least in part a real orchestra? It takes a little bit more time than recording a real orchestra. Obviously, you have professional musicians. Like, I have to play each part like 16 to 20 times. You know, I have to sing it. I have to sing the same part. I have to sing the tenor and baritone and bass parts all each, like, you know, 12 times or something like that. So it takes a little bit more time, and then you have to get it approved by the director, and sometimes they have notes, and then you got to record them all 16, 20 tracks again. But that's the fun part to me. That's where we're talking about, like, the fun of the job, you know, the being playful is getting to, you know, record myself as a fake men's chorus, you know. And we took it a step further in the sequel, where we translated more than just blood and honey. So there's like different Latin phrases. And so the next part of your question, in your two-part question, was how did we expand? That's a really great question. I hired we brought on a couple of more musicians. So I brought on a soprano soloist, an old friend of mine from university, Anna Foy. She recorded some sopranos, like textures and stuff. And this time I was able to have an assistant, whereas the first time was just me all by myself scoring everything. This time I got to bring a team in a little bit, a score recording engineer to come and set up microphones and advise on which microphones to get, and come into the studio and spend some time setting things up with me and making plans. So I had a little bit more resources to play with and be flexible with. But at the end of the day, I'm still at a point where even if I have a team of a couple of people, it's still mostly me layering and recording things. And let me try to find that. You can hear Anna here in this scene. It's really, really lovely. I'll go back a little bit. Here she comes right here. She is. That high note. Then another one. That really high note. She's really great. She's fantastic. So yeah, I got to work with a couple of musicians and bring in other people other than just myself, and then hire a team of, like I said, my buddy Christian was kind of a scoring recording engineer coming in and helping with some microphones. I'll get to spend a little bit of that. Whereas the first movie, I invested myself completely on the soundtrack release and doing the mastering files of those soundtracks. Mm-hmm. I get to now allocate a little bit of the budget from Winnie the Pooh 2 towards mastering and getting this soundtrack out and maybe doing some album artwork and stuff like that. So, but I think, you know, just by the nature of the way that I work, which is once I sign a contract, I and my manager and I finish negotiating the, you know, the budget, I just stop thinking about it, except for in the way that, like, if I have money to play with, I can pay other people to come in. But it doesn't, I guess, in terms of like how I write the score and my process, the budget only gives me more tools to play with, but it doesn't mm-hmm. affect my process in writing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And as we wrap up, I do want to hit one more question on the Winnie the Pooh films. Obviously, the first one caught a lot of positive and negative attention.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people online being, like, just really fucking annoying about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you engage with them sometimes. And I just wanted to ask, like, Andrew, why are you doing that?
I can't. I don't know. I know I should not be a reply guy. I know it's awful. I don't know. I don't. There's some. I think this is all new to be honest. The truth is, this is all new to me. And I think I'm on a bit of a learning curve stretch right now, which is like, let me take a breath. I think especially early on, like when the first movie was like before the first movie came out and when it did come out, like last year, this time I was in a pretty rough place because you're very proud of these movies that you are part of. Even mm-hmm. if it's like a B movie, Winnie the Pooh slasher, I still know how hard the team worked, you know, the limited resources that we had. And then, you know, see tweets that are like, don't spend money on Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, go see Ant-Man Quantumania instead. And it's like, one is made for $50,000 and one was literally made for $200 million. I guess it can be frustrating knowing how hard the team worked with just not, I won't even say the bare minimum. Like, it's like negative resources. Like Vince, the cinematographer, you know, he didn't have the budget for the lights. He was bringing his own stuff, you know, not even charging them. Everybody was going above and beyond the $50,000 budget because you can't make a movie for this for $50,000. Like, the only other comparable movie was, at the time, was Skinamarink. I really loved that movie, but it was still around the same budget. And it was, mm-hmm. it's one location inside a house with yeah. like a kid and some toys. Amazing. I loved the movie. I had a lot of fun watching it. I think it's a really inventive film, but compared to like riding a car and a car exploding and like 17 different locations, I don't know how many locations, but we had maybe 10 like locations in the woods, in the mud, driving scenes, drone shots, Airbnbs, you know, fire pits, guns, practical blood, CGI. Like, there's so much more that goes into what we tried to pull off for around the same budget. Maybe that was foolishness and on their part and my part and our part. I guess to answer your question, I'm doing the reply guy thing in this interview, but I feel very proud of the team. And I feel like it's very easy to dunk on an indie movie taking a big swing that I kind of jump into the comments, I guess. I'm trying to be better at it. The biggest one that gets to me, I think, is when people are like, this movie should never have been in theaters. And I think I understand what they're saying, that like a theatrical release has a certain expectation of budget. But I don't know a single director who, when, I mean, it was, I guess, Reese's choice, the director's choice ultimately, but the theatrical release was presented to him based on how viral the first movie went.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants their work to be seen. And I just don't know a single director that would say, let me limit my audience and let less people see this movie. You know, well, it's not even about ticket sales or anything. It's just about like getting your movie in theaters is, I think, everybody's dream in film.
The only example I know of the opposite was with the new Roadhouse movie. Amazon had given Doug Liman, the director, the option of Prime only or in theaters. But if you do it on Prime, we'll give you an extra $20 million.
Oh, see, that's, yeah.
And then when they finished the movie, he was like, oh, by the way, I still want it in theaters.
Yeah. There you go. I mean, I think that's, yeah, I mean, I know that a lot of people say the theater experience is dying away and it's all going to go to streaming. But in all of our hearts, we still want all the people who make work on movies, we still want the movies that we work on to go in theater and for the lights to go down and for humans to sit in a black box quietly and have an experience together and then walk away as strangers, you know?
Well, and I'll say we're recording this March 3rd. 2 days ago, Dune Part 2 premiered in theaters. You want to talk about the necessity of a theatrical experience is...
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, a film, like, yeah, you can watch it at home, but it's incomparable. It's incomparable.
Yeah. Oh my God, I can't wait to see Dune 2. I'm told, there's like a group thread with everyone. Mm-hmm. I'm told that the Winnie the Pooh 2 trailer plays in front of Dune 2 for some reason. I think that's so funny. I don't think there's a lot of crossover between... I mean, actually, no, that's not true. But then again, like, it's just like the Ant-Man Quantumania thing. It's like they're there to see Dune 2, which probably had a bigger budget than Ant-Man Quantumania. And here's our $300,000, which is much better than the first one, but here's our $300,000 micro-budget slasher. Yeah. You want to go see it? I'm really proud of the second one. I was really proud of the first one. You know, for it being kind of a throwback to 80s slashers. I think I get defensive of it because I guess I'm just too proud of the team for, and I just know how hard everybody worked. I'm on that learning curve, but even if you want to say like it was a talentless, effortless cash grab, I just happen to know that we all tried with the limited resources we had to make something fun.
I'll also say, and I won't like specify any movies, but I watch a lot of like micro budget indie horror movies. You go on Tubi and there's like 5,000 of them.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I'll say like a lot of those are, I mean, they're bad movies, but like that's just part of what happens when people only have a small amount of money and an experience. It's just like how filmmaking goes. And I always think someone saying that about Blood and Honey 1, it's like you've never watched real indie horror. Like,
right,
a low budget film like that is not unique to Blood and Honey. Like, that's the thing that annoys me. One of the things that annoys me about seeing it is like, you guys just don't even, you're commenting on something that you truly just have no familiarity with at all.
You're right. I think Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey 1 was a lot of people's introduction to micro slashers.
Yeah.
You know, you see the comment that's like, it's the worst movie I've ever seen. And I'm just like, I guess you don't watch many. You haven't seen a lot of 80s horrors when they like the slasher craze came after Halloween. There were like Thanksgiving murder movies, one called Blood Rage, which I watch every Thanksgiving. It's awful. Like, I mean, but in the best way, like there's a line read in Blood Rage that is like, it's not cranberry sauce. And it's just, you know, like if you're into the micro budget, low budget slashers, like there's plenty to enjoy and all of them are enjoyable, but. And I might be biased, but I think Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey is far from the worst movie ever made. I think it's a really fun movie. The other thing I think often about when I'm deciding not to comment or sometimes commenting is that Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey didn't like not deliver what it was promising to anybody who like bought a ticket. You know, I can't imagine like a twisted, dark, psychological taking itself bare. I don't know. I mean, like, you saw the trailer, you saw the posters, like Winnie the Pooh with a bloody hammer. I think it delivered exactly what it was saying it was going to be, especially to those who know low budget horror movies on like Tubi and other places. It just so happened that it went in theaters and a lot of people who've never seen that genre got to watch that for the first time and were a little bit confused, maybe.
maybe. Yeah. Hey, well, I'm curious to see how the second film turns out. I'm hoping that on my Twitter feed, I don't see you replying to the haters and the trolls once that drops.
You know what? There's one more voice of reason in my head to tell me not to. So thank you. I will do my best. Yeah, because sometimes people can be pretty mean. I guess that's the other thing is I just don't understand the meanness of people sometimes, but when it's all anonymous, I guess it doesn't matter. I don't know. And then you get sucked into it, man. I get sucked into it. I got to be better. You're inspiring me to be better. Thank you.
Excellent. Hey, Andrew, it was great talking to you. Like I said, looking forward to the film. I'm glad you had all these cues and samples and instruments at hand. it's fun listening along. And I know that the reason for that is because you're still bitter that your friends 25 years ago wouldn't listen to Tomorrow Never Dies with you. So you found someone that will.
That's right. Come and listen to soundtracks with me. You're welcome anytime.